Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak.
I'm Nell Larson.
And joining us in the first part of the show are a couple of individuals that are here to talk about, some of the wildlife projects they have going on, citizen science, and perhaps how some of our listeners can get involved in some of these projects going on this summer. They include Dr. Mary Pendergast. She is an ecologist with the nonprofit Wild Utah Project, and Austin Green. He is currently a PhD candidate at the University of Utah and is a member working with Wasatch Wildlife Watch. So thanks so much for joining us this morning on the show. Let's start with you, Mary. Let's talk to us a little bit about Wild Utah Project, what they're about, their mission, objectives, etc.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us today. Wild Utah Project's mission is to provide science in service of wildlife and land conservation. And we do this by a number of means. We do collaborate with academicians and do more traditional research projects. We also provide GIS support and mapping tools to conservation groups, as well as state and federal municipalities and agencies. And then we also provide community science programs in which we convert more standardized scientific methods or protocols used in the field, often by Forest Service or Division of Wildlife Resources, and we convert those methods into usable tools and teachable tools where community or citizen scientists can get trained to use those protocols and help collect data on the landscape, be it on wildlife itself or the condition of those habitats. And so we really benefit from leveraging the power of our community scientists and citizen scientists, because otherwise we couldn't collect the magnitude of data or quantify some of the variables we're interested in without that support.
So we're going to dig into Wasatch Wildlife Watch in a minute here, but give us an overview of some of the other projects that you're working on right now at the organization.
So particularly our community science programs involve the Wildlife Watch, which we'll hear about more in a minute. We also do amphibian surveys and habitat assessments. As I'm sure a lot of your listeners are aware, amphibians are a good indicator for how our aquatic systems are doing. We also have a program where we do rapid riparian and stream assessment. So we train folks to do a rapid assessment, but using very standardized, robust methods to assess the health of stream and riparian habitats. And we often do that protocol before or after having community scientists support in putting in beaver dam analogs, so human-made analogs to the natural beaver dams, which increases the footprint and the duration we have water, which we know is critical in the Intermountain West. Another program we are just launching is a monarch and milkweed mapping project, and we're doing that in collaboration with the state as well as Utah State. And then in addition, we have a Rosie Finch program that is just launching, where we have retrofitted bird feeders to read, they're called pit tags, but they're passive transmitter tags that are put on the bird's bands, and then when the bird goes to the feeder, we make a note of that occurrence. So we're learning more about those species as well.
Why the Rosie Finch?
So the Rosie Finch is one of our lesser known in terms of natural history, but it's also one of those species that occupies those higher elevation terrains. So some of the beautiful landscapes that we're seeing right here from the location of your station.
Very cool.
So what you say you do science for other, let's say for other environmental organizations like Wasatch Wildlife Watch.
Mm-hmm.
Cut that. What are other groups you might provide data to?
Yeah, so often what we do, and Austin will tell you more about his program, but he's a PhD student at the University of Utah. And so in order to have a more robust research program, the more data you can gather, the more complete your statistical analyses would be, the more gaps you're filling on the landscape just in terms of where the habitat is and where species are occurring. And so we partner with all of the academicians in the state. We also work with municipalities and groups like the Central Wasatch Commission, which some of your listeners may have heard of. We work with the city. We work with UDOT. We work with very often the Division of Wildlife Resources and helping them fill data gaps. You know, they only have so many staff that can do field research, and the more
only so much money.
And only exactly.
A lot of that.
And the same is true with the Forest Service and Fish and Wildlife. So if there's a conservation need or a decision that needs to be made or a prioritization for where to restore habitats, and we can support gathering more data or doing assessments of those habitats, we try to do that so they can make the most informed decisions and also have as much data as possible for any research component.
Well, one of the really big projects, obviously, that you have going on right now is Wasatch Wildlife Watch. So, Austin, let's turn to you and tell us a little bit about how this partnership came about and what was kind of the motivation to start this particular project.
Yeah, of course. So thank you very much for having me on the show. And so this project started as kind of an undergraduate dream we had at the Biodiversity and Conservation Ecology Lab at the U. So we were doing some work on wildlife in Red Butte Canyon specifically.
Okay.
And so I was working with another graduate student at the time, and we had this idea to expand a current project that we were working on. We were looking at the wildlife in Red Butte, and we were saying, okay, is there any way we can make this project larger? Is there any way we could make this have a larger impact on the environment? We know a lot about what's going on in Red Butte. We don't know a lot about what's going on with the rest of the Wasatch. And so we kind of got together. We went down to the Wildlife Society meeting for Utah, and that's where we met Mary, and that's where we met Wild Utah Project.
Okay.
And they were really interested in expanding the project and involving some type of community science aspect. And we thought this would be perfect to make it so that we could really have this project go at a larger scale. We could get a lot more area covered, we could have a lot more cameras, and it would make it so that we wouldn't just be looking at a small scale area like Red Butte, we could expand it and start looking at areas throughout the entire Wasatch. And so we could have that huge citizen science base and gather all this incredible data with help from a ton of just really awesome people.
And it, as we were kind of talking about before we came on air, has really like taken off faster than you even expected. So how many cameras, how many volunteers? Tell us about it.
Yeah, so it's really gotten quite the notoriety, which is really great. So currently there's 231 camera stations that are being set up. So last year marked our first year of survey, and we got about 205 set up. We then expanded that to 231 this year. And we have about 300 or so, a little over 300 people involved in the project. And it is covering at least 1,000 square kilometers at this point. So we go from City Creek Canyon all the way to Little Cottonwood Canyon, and then as far west as the Jordan River, and as far east as Park City.
And how do you determine the locations for these cameras? You know, are you guys doing mapping and then putting them in strategic locations, or are you more worried about what's accessible for a volunteer to get to? Like, how does that decision get made?
So it's a little bit of both.
Okay.
And so we had to start.
Can't have volunteers like scaling cliffs.
Yeah.
And...
well, you'd be surprised. We get some pretty incredible stories at the end of the year. But yeah, and so it started off basically all that previous research. And so this is the second year of Wasatch Wildlife Watch. But before that, we were doing about 5 years of research with camera traps in Red Butte. And the main thing that came from that is identifying environmental variables, or basically just identifying spots on the landscape that are more conducive for wildlife camera trapping than others. And the biggest thing that we identified is that areas of high slope, you know, obviously are just not really great areas to set up cameras. They end up taking a lot of photos because you get a lot of sun exposure, a lot of basically grass blowing in the wind. But then not only that, you really just don't get a ton of wildlife that are using those areas. Just like human beings aren't going to want to go on a ridge, wildlife aren't as well. And so basically to identify these locations for Wasatch Wildlife Watch, we excluded areas of really high slope, which really ended up excluding a lot of the Wasatch, and kind of made it so that we were focusing on the major washes, major riparian areas. And then within there, we basically just systematically set up a camera station every kilometer or so. And so there are some locations, most of the locations follow some type of water source, but there are plenty that are kind of off trail, really in the thicket. And that's where the community scientists come into such great utility, is that they're able to go out there. We have a lot of really interested people, and they're accessing these locations that otherwise would be pretty difficult to get to.
What kind of animals are you seeing?
So we're seeing anything. Basically, the study is focusing on medium to large mammals. The reason we really want to focus on those is camera traps are really great for identifying mammals. They work basically by sensing heat in motion. So anything with body heat or any type of heat signature at all that's moving around, these cameras are going to pick up. And so mammals are really great because they're on the ground, and so the cameras are easy to pick them up. They were actually designed for that. And so we're looking at anything basically from the size of a skunk to a moose. And so we've been getting basically skunk, moose, and everything in between.
Right.
A lot of mountain lion, a lot of bobcat, a few black bear,
nice.
A lot of mule deer. Mule deer are dominating the landscape, you know, elk, moose, and just about everything in between.
Any surprises? Any badgers?
Lots of
wolverines.
Badgers.
Yeah.
Wolverines. Oh, no wolverines, but
yet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We say yet. Yeah. Let's put a big yet on that.
We've got some surprises, though.
Right.
So, for instance, we didn't know that we'd necessarily get things like gopher snakes, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the orientation of the camera and the light has a lot to do with whether or not you're going to pick something up so close to the ground like that.
Right.
Yeah.
But there they are.
There they
right.
are.
Yep, exactly.
Some
birds
other...
are yeah. birds too fast to come in and out of the
it
kinda they have to perch.
Yeah, it kind of
okay.
depends on the bird. We did get a northern goshawk last year. And we get a lot of like more ground dwelling birds like your grouse and your wild turkey.
Right.
And we include those in the analysis because they
sure.
you know, we have them enough, but songbirds and stuff, they usually will trigger the camera, but they're flying so fast out of it that by the time the photos
right.
are taken, they're usually out of the frame. But every now and then you do get a songbird. But the reptiles are really interesting because it kind of just shows how hot they get from sitting out in the sun.
That's
yeah.
what I was thinking.
Yeah, and so usually, you know, they're cold-blooded animals, so that's why the cameras aren't really great at picking them up. But it, you can really tell when one's been sunbathing because then once they move across the camera, they have enough of a heat signature
yeah.
to set it off. Mm-hmm. So those are really, really cool when you get those.
I think my favorite surprise, though, a lot of people don't know this, but we have flying squirrel in the Wasatch. And
no
it,
way.
We are just very lucky that we captured it. And
yeah.
the reason was we had a group of mule deer moving around. And so there was a series of photos taken that way. And it just so happens in the canopy in those same moments. You can see it almost looks like a waffle being thrown across the field of view. And it's a flying squirrel.
Really? So if I happen to come upon one, is it a much larger than a normal squirrel or is it?
They're about the
is
same.
Is there a signature? Okay.
Yeah, they're about the same as.
You'd literally have to see
yeah.
it take off to
yep.
to say, what?
Yep.
Wait a minute. That's
what
a flying
that? Yeah.
squirrel, not a
right.
Not right. Another type of squirrel.
Right.
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 Okay. So you're taking all these photos. How many a week? I mean, give me a number. Give me an
right.
estimate of how many photos you're collecting.
So we're still entering photos from the first year. And currently it looks like we will have, by the time it's all said and done, about 800,000 photographs that these cameras take took over the course of a year. That equates. So a lot of that is they're false triggers, basically. And
sure.
so a lot of that's either the sun or swaying vegetation. And so when it's all said and done, I think about 90,000 or so are wildlife photographs. And so then those are the ones that get entered into the actual database.
Wow.
But still, 90,000 was quite a bit. And more so, I think, than we were planning for. So it's been really great. Basically, we're still trying to enter all that data. We've had about 180 of the cameras entered so far. So we've only got a little bit more to go. And then we can really start some large-scale analysis on this data set.
I was just going to ask, do you have like specific research questions that you're trying to answer about, you know, like presence, absence, or distribution of like specific species? Or are you more just looking for a general overview to generate a map of, you know, what's where out there?
Right. So it's a bit of both.
Okay.
And so the main questions are, can we identify how many species are using certain areas, and specifically how that relates to differing levels of human impact or human activity? And so the main reason we've chosen the Wasatch is it's one of the best examples of a wildland-urban interface. And it's not only a great example of a wildland-urban interface, but it also has so much intermix in it. And so you have so many different levels of human activity throughout the Wasatch, and it's also the most highly recreated national forest in the United States. And so it has that added component as well. And so with that, we can then relate how human beings are basically affecting different wildlife species in different areas and relate that back to different environmental factors. And so that's the first question, basically, is how are humans affecting the landscape in a more non-invasive way? So what type of recreational activities are occurring in the Wasatch, and how are those affecting wildlife? It's not typically something that we look at in science. We more look at like housing density and stuff like that, and how that affects it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the first one. And then a really large question, and this is a question that's really pertinent to Wild Utah Project and the state and federal municipalities that are involved, is identifying these really core habitat areas throughout the Wasatch. Where are these areas where we can identify really important areas for wildlife, possibly some areas that might need some type of restoration or connection through a corridor, and as well as areas, you know, and so the Wasatch is going to be continuously developed. That's something that we know as the population increases. And so can we do that development basically sustainably? And so can we identify maybe the most low-value habitat for certain species as well? And so we kind of want to get that whole spectrum. We want to identify really where are these core areas, where are these kind of sources for a lot of these wildlife populations, where are they running into some issues, and how can we best basically sustain this population for the future.
You know, in those conversations right now, there's so much guesswork that's being done.
Right.
So much like, well, we think that, or, you know, we would anticipate this kind of disruption impacts the wildlife, or, you know, this kind of development. And so it'll be really interesting to see how that data all comes together. We need that for the Wasatch back, too. That's next, right?
Yes. Yeah. So that is in the works. Don't know if it'll be done by the time I'm graduated, just because it does require more resources. But, yeah, we do want to definitely expand this project and, you know, be able to get to a larger area. And, you know, the more data you have, the better a data set is. And so it can answer more questions.
Well, let's turn back to Dr. Pendergast. You talked about some other projects you're working on, like the monarch butterfly. No, you had a speaker.
Yeah, we did.
And so what are you, can you talk a little bit, say, for example, what are you looking for with respect to the monarch? What's going on?
Sure. I think folks are generally aware that we are experiencing lots of population declines in insects in general, but in particular, we're concerned about those pollinators. And then monarchs are a quintessential example of just extreme declines nationwide. And there's a lot of research being done right now on the migratory pathways. And there's, if you were to look at kind of a distribution map and what we know about where crucial habitat are for monarch, there's kind of a gap where Utah occurs. And so we're just trying to do anything we can to help map where potentially suitable habitats are, so where the different species of milkweed and in particular larger patches of milkweed occur. Those tend to be along riparian corridors. And then while we're kind of ground truthing a predictive model where potential habitat could be, we're also having community scientists use an application on their phones to help identify monarchs themselves or anything that might indicate the presence of monarchs or eggs or even other pollinators.
So I could be out just on a hike and come upon a monarch or a milkweed or some other important piece of information, take a photo of it, you know, stamp it in some form. Time and place, and then upload it.
Yep, that's it.
And that's where citizen science plays a role on
that's
everyday activity with the monarch.
That's it. And there's varying levels of engagement, both for the both of these projects we're talking about. So for monarchs, for example, if you go to Monarch Utah Conservation, if you just search for that, a website will come up and it talks about different levels of engagement. So what you just described is an opportunistic survey just while you're out. You can download the application and do that. You can also get more deeply engaged and be assigned a site that you go to multiple times a year. So you might be able to detect the different life stages of the monarch while you're out and kind of have stewardship over a site. For the Wasatch Wildlife Watch, I just wanted to mention not only are our community scientists spending an entire day at the Natural History Museum at the launch of the field season to learn how to install and monitor cameras, but also they participate in this huge lift at the end, which is sorting through all these photos.
Ah, that's what I was wondering about.
800,000.
And that's so just year one.
That's year one. Right. So a person would receive a file full of thousands of photos, let's say, then given it a set of tasks or what to look for, and then what? Put them into a database or a spreadsheet or something.
So I'll let Austin talk a little bit more about the eMammal platform, maybe at our next.
And so so basically, when volunteers set up cameras, they're then given the opportunity, if they want to also enter the data from those cameras, and so they're the ones that are maintaining that camera throughout the season. And so as they rotate the camera, they then have the SD card from the last site. They can upload that SD card directly to our eMammal project website. And so if you just search Wasatch Wildlife Watch, it'll take you directly to our eMammal project. And there's basically a way to get involved in the project from there. There's like a join project button. But if you're already a member of the project, you can basically just create an account. It's a free account. And then you just sign up to enter the photos. And you can enter the photos either from your camera or from someone else's camera. And that just basically requires looking at the SD card, and then basically opening up a program. It then says, all right, what do you see in the photo? You just identify the species you see in the photo. You send it to us. So once you upload it, then it's reviewed by the actual researchers to make sure you got the identification correct. So it doesn't require basically an expert naturalist to know exactly what you're looking at. You just give it your best guess.
It's multiple choice.
It's multiple choice.
Because, I mean, there, you know, you may not, you say, well, that's a snake.
Sure.
But I'm not quite sure what.
Sure.
So you there is a QA/QC procedure that you go back through.
Exactly, yeah. And so they do the initial upload, and then we do a review on the back end. And we have to look through every single photo. But what's good about the back end review, and what really makes this so great if volunteers are uploading those photos, is that we only have to review the animal identifications.
Right.
And so they are basically saving us a ton of time, because like I said, there's 800,000 photos that are uploaded. We only have to review 90,000, which still seems like a lot, but it makes it way easier for us when we just have to look at the wildlife photos and be like, oh, yeah, that is a mule deer, that is an elk, or we need to change an identification here and there every now and then.
Okay.
But that's where the value really comes in with these community scientists, uploading all these photos, identifying what species you see in the photos.
Just a couple more minutes. What about field work? Are there any opportunities for our listeners to get in, if they want to get involved and actually go out there and
absolutely
get their hands dirty or so?
Yeah, if you're interested in the Wasatch Wildlife Watch or any of the other community science programs we talked about today, you can go to wildutahproject.org.
Okay.
And then if you go to the projects tab, all the programs we just talked about are listed. And so you can go to each of those, and there's a get involved button or a join us button, and you'll be entered into that email listserv, and we will let you know about different trainings and ways to participate.
Fantastic. Exactly.
Yeah, well said, Chris.
Team effort. Well, Dr. Mary Pendergast, ecologist with Wild Utah Project, and Austin Green, PhD candidate at the University of Utah and with the Wasatch Wildlife Watch. Thank you so much for joining us. And again, it's Wild Utah Project, all one word, .org. And the website
is just Wasatch Wildlife Watch. And so it's just the eMammal project. So it's basically eMammal's the larger project that houses a bunch of camera trapping projects. But if you just search Wasatch Wildlife Watch, it'll be the first project that shows up. You just click on that, and that'll take you exactly where you need to go.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for joining us. And you know what? We're going to have you back you know, let's say 5 or 6 months to give us an update on what you're
Sounds
finding
good. Oh, that'd
be fantastic. And how citizens can continue to assist
Sounds
in field and photo review efforts.
Thank you.